If you would be turning in your Bibles to the book of 1 Chronicles. And while you're turning there, let me take a moment to express my appreciation. First to Dick, who got our projector up in between Sundays. So he did a real good job of getting that up and getting that installed so we could have our PowerPoint. I was wondering if for a moment we were going to have to cancel services with that not being there. But he was able to get that up and get that back in place. And I'm thankful that he was able to jump on that and get that taken care of just real quick. I'd also like to thank Jim for the prayer that he just led us in. You know, prayer is such an essential part of our worship. It's a way in which we lift our voices and unite them together and bring our petition and bring our cares and bring everything before God and lay it before Him. And one of the things that stood out to me in Jim's prayer, and probably to you as well, was oftentimes in the midst of tragedy and in the midst of hardship, we pray for those who are on the receiving end of that. But Jim also in his prayer brought out the ones who are on the giving end of that tragedy. Those, he talked about the gunmen and all of the shootings that we've been having, the perpetrators of those who have evil and darkness dwelling within them. And as he pointed out, the only way to change that innate darkness is through the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that's what our Savior came to do. That's what He commissioned His apostles to do, was to change the evil in man by pointing them toward God, pointing them toward the hope and the promises that we sang about in our songs this morning. And, you know, the real tragedy, of course, not only is the needless violence and loss of life and homes that are destroyed and broken up because of that, but the soul that's lost by the one who has succumbed to such needless atrocities and has such vengeance and hate dwelling within them. And there's only one thing to change that, and that's the gospel. And the only way in which an age and a day will come in which there is no more of that, which Jim also prayed for, is the return of Jesus Christ and the perfection and the recreation of all things. And that great day where God will wipe away every tear from our eyes and there will be no more of the sin and the violence and the loss and all of those terrible things. And so we come together to remind ourselves, come quickly, Lord Jesus, come quickly. Doing our overview of individual books of the Bible, and we've arrived at Chronicles, and I confess to you that I have wrestled with this one more than any of the others. And as we get into the content of this, you'll probably understand why in just a little bit. But 1st and 2nd Chronicles, like the predecessors that came before it, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and 1st and 2nd Kings, it too was a single book. And whenever the Bible was translated from Hebrew to Greek, and Hebrew, remember, has only consonants, no vowels, and is translated to Greek, and the vowels were inserted, the length of the text just about doubled for all intents and purposes. They had to take and break the books down into two parts because they're simply too long to put on a single scroll. And so the book of Chronicles, as does Kings and as did Samuel, tells a complete, comprehensive story with no breakdown in the middle. That being said, there is a pretty good division that the translators have chosen where they have split the books in two. When we come to the book of 1st and 2nd Chronicles, or the books rather of 1st and 2nd Chronicles, we're coming to probably some of the most overlooked literature in all of the Bible. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, because we aren't Jews. And so we miss out largely on the intent and the purpose that was driving this book, which we're going to discuss in detail a little bit later on. Especially the first nine chapters. 1 Chronicles 1 through 9, I kid you not, is probably some of the most boring literature in the Bible. And if you've tried to read through that, then you know that the first nine chapters of 1 Chronicles probably rivals the book of Leviticus. This is the kind of stuff you read to your kids when you're trying to get them to go to sleep at night. I mean, it's just name after name after name. And being a non-Jew, we can't appreciate genealogies. We can't appreciate the purpose of genealogies. Let me just show you. Let's read 1 Chronicles 1, verses 1 through 4. Expose you to some of its greatness here. 1 Chronicles 1, 1 through 4. Adam, Seth, Enosh. Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared. Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech. Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And you could go on for nine chapters, and what you have in the book of 1 Chronicles is nine full chapters of genealogy. Name after name after name. And so what this does, while it may appear to us to be quite a bore and challenge us and jeopardize our yearly Bible reading program so that we give up and stop, what actually is taking place here is brilliant on behalf of the chronicler, the one who wrote this book. What he is doing, he is starting with Adam And he is weaving the entire story of the Bible from Adam to David and beyond by simply using names. In fact, if you read through these names, then several memorable figures will come to your mind. But this goes on for 9 chapters. And so for the Jews, this wasn't just a boring list of names and family lineage. This was the retelling of the story from Adam to David to beyond in an annotated form. And if we stop and we think about this, we will call to mind some of the great names who stand out here to us. So this is overlooked because of the way that it begins, and it's hard to really dig your feet into and to read from beginning to end. That's one of the reasons why. Secondly, it's overlooked oftentimes because it follows the books of Samuel and Kings. And when you find yourself reading through this, you finally get through all of the genealogies, you start reading and you say, hey, this is the same stuff that I just read back in 1 and 2 Samuel and back in 1 and 2 Kings. And so we're getting now Bible reruns. God has given us spiritual leftovers. And so there's this tendency when we get to this book to skip it and write it off and say, I've been here before. I know what happens. Just going to move on to greener pastures, newer fields, and things of that nature. However, it's a detriment if we choose to do so. Because it's estimated 50 to 60% of what's recorded for us in 1 and 2 Chronicles is not recorded in the accounts of Samuel and in the accounts of the kings. So you're looking at a significant portion of new material. Secondly, and more importantly, what's happening is God is repeating himself in a way. And God has done this throughout Bible literature. In fact, he does this at the very outset of the Bible. Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. Genesis 1 gives you a general account of creation. And Genesis 2 is a repeat of that creation. But while there's some overlap, it also fills in some of the specifics that you might miss out on as to how God goes about doing exactly what it is that he does during the time period of creation. So while there's this overlap, there's also the filling in of the gaps as well. And it's not just the recapitulation of Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. The book of Deuteronomy overlaps with much of Numbers and Leviticus and Exodus as it's a recounting of the law. But at the same time, it fills in a lot of gaps that are left there in those three books. The Gospels as well, they tell the same story. However, they're each written from a unique perspective. And what each of the authors of the Gospel do is they bring in a unique view and information that is unique to the Gospel. And so by looking at all four of them, we now have a greater understanding of the life of Jesus. And such it is with 1 and 2 Chronicles. So I encourage you, as I have with the other books, jump into these books and try to read through them in the upcoming month. If you have to do so and to complete the book, skip through the genealogies. I hope you'll develop a greater appreciation for them after we're done. But if you have to just jump into the story itself, the narrative, start in chapter 10, read through, and you'll find a lot of things that are there that simply weren't recorded in the book of Samuel and in the book of Kings. So let me very briefly just mention the who and when. That is, who wrote the book and when did they write it? It's largely believed by the Jews that the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles, or rather the book of Chronicles, was written by Ezra. The reason being, Ezra was a priest, Ezra was a scribe, Ezra was a teacher of the law. And so he'd be very familiar with Jewish history. He'd be very familiar with the history and the past and how it all fit together. And as we're going to see, he would be pushing toward the purpose of the book, as we're going to see later on. And so while he's not listed and identified within the book himself, it's believed that Ezra wrote the book. And it was believed to have been written from 450 to 430 B.C. You can dig into those boring genealogies and you find out that after the return from captivity, after the return from Babylonian exile, 6 generations are carried forward in the genealogies that are given. And so that estimates this book to have been written just in this general time period. Now, there's a couple things we do know about the book of Chronicles, and not just a whole lot more. One of them is the prayer of Jabez. And the prayer of Jabez, although it's hidden in the genealogies, has garnered a degree of popularity within probably the last 20 years or so. Somebody read through these genealogies. Somebody found a couple of verses that spoke of this man named Jabez, and one person goes on to write a book about it. And because of that, the discovery of this book, many sermons have been preached, two of which I have contributed in my time here to the prayer of Jabez, this man who is simply given a very brief narrative of his life in a couple of verses. And Secondly, the promises to a nation. We see there not only that, God's promise to Israel. And let me just read this to you. I don't believe I have it on the screen. Nope, I don't. Let me just read this to you. It's in 2 Chronicles 7:14. And if you know a passage from Chronicles, it's probably this one. The chronicler writes, "And my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and forgive their sin and heal their land." Okay, you probably heard that verse used before. Let me just very briefly say and then move on. That statement was not made, that promise was not given to the great United States of America. And while it's true that righteousness exalts a nation, and if there is anything that is going to pull back the judgment of God and postpone it for the national atrocities that we have committed, it's going to be a turn to God, it's going to be righteousness. This promise was made to ancient Israel. And if it's in God's plan and in God's purpose to humble this nation, to bring it down to size, then it doesn't matter what righteousness may be demonstrated by us. And so we don't need to take and apply that to the United States. That was promised to national Israel, that if they would turn back to God, then God would heal their land and remove those curses. So what I want to talk about for the next few minutes is the difference between the books of Chronicles, Samuel, and Kings, because that's probably the biggest problem most of us have when we come to this particular book. How is it really any different than the books that preceded? How is it different than Samuel and Kings? And when you sit down and when you read it, and hopefully this will help your understanding the next time you do read through this great book, you'll have an appreciation for the things that it says. There are a number of differences. I believe I've got 8 listed, distinguishing between Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. The books of Samuel and Kings record a different time period. It's the same amount of time, about 500 years, but it begins with Samuel. You'll remember Hannah's prayer there at the beginning. The birth of Samuel the prophet, the establishment of prophets through his lineage and his ministry, and carries the people all the way to exile. That's where the book of 2 Kings ends. It's the children of Judah, they're in Babylonian exile. And that's believed where those books were completed. Chronicles, however, starts with David and brings you back into the return, that is, the release from exile. Whenever Cyrus sent out the decree saying that the Jews were to go back home and they could rebuild Jerusalem and reestablish themselves as a nation, you've got a slightly different period of time. And another thing that we could bring in is the time in which it was written. Samuel and Kings was written shortly after. The reason being, it answers 2 different questions. Samuel and Kings answers the question, why? God's people in captivity say, why has God forsaken us? Why has God done this? Read the record. See what happened. Look at your unfaithfulness. This is why God has done this. Chronicles is, however, written long after the return. And we'll get to the question that it answers in a little while further down our lesson. In Samuel and Kings, you have the political history. This is the perspective that it's written from. You have the political history recorded. That is, you have every king, good and bad, what they've done, and just kind of a general recognition of what they did for Israel or for Judah. And when you come to Chronicles, you have more of a religious history. And you'll see this in the viewpoint in which it was written. Samuel and Kings was written in a prophetic viewpoint. And you'll remember that the ministries of Elijah and Elisha take up about a third of the book of Kings. And so it's written from the viewpoint of a prophet, where prophets go to the kings or sent by God and they say, this is what you need to do, or this is what's going to happen. And they're trying to turn Israel around, and that record is there, written from that viewpoint. However, Chronicles is written from a priestly viewpoint. This, by the way, is one of the reasons that is believed that Ezra wrote this book. But Chronicles is written from a priestly viewpoint. They're very concerned with the temple. They're very concerned with the Ark of the Covenant. They're very concerned with what the kings are doing regarding the temple, regarding idolatry. Okay, and that's kind of the details that they are given and written in because of the 2 different viewpoints. And for Samuel and Kings, you have a record of both the northern and the southern kingdom. Remember, Israel, while it's reigned by Saul, David, and Solomon, later divides. And it's once a unified nation, but it becomes divided. Part is given to Rehoboam in the south, Judah, and the 10 northern tribes are given to Jeroboam. And you got a record there, back and forth, and this is what makes Kings hard to read. Kind of flip-flopping, you know, you're talking about a Judean king, and then you read about an Israel king, and back and forth it goes, describing both north and southern kingdoms. Chronicles, however, is not concerned with northern Israel. It's only concerned with the kings of Judah. That is what's going on there in the southern kingdom. So those two perspectives and those two kingdoms are recounted in that way. Samuel and Kings is emphasizing the human failures. And you get a very depressed sense of the history of Israel when you read through the books of Samuel and the books of Kings. It's tough to read, and it's just evil act after evil act after evil act. Idolatry, turning away from God, refusing to repent. And you see the human failings brought out. While in Judah, what you have brought out is covenant faithfulness that preserves the people of Judah. Now, this is interesting. The books of Samuel and Kings largely record the royal vices. The author shows us the good, the bad, and the ugly. Even among the best of kings, you see their failings unbiasedly put on display for the reader. We read of David's adultery with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. We read of David's failure as a father to impart any discipline to his children. And we see the terrible tragedies that come up as a result of his neglect. We read of Solomon's 700 wives and 300 concubines. We read of God coming to him in dreams and Solomon's disobedience to the direct command of God. We read of Solomon worshiping the gods of the Sidonians and the Amorites. We see him building the high places to the Moabites, to Chemosh, and to the Ammonite abomination Molech. Now, you have the good, the bad, and the ugly in Kings, but in Chronicles, largely what you are given is the virtues. That's what's being brought out. Not all of the ugly things that happen, primarily the virtues. Now, there are some of the sins and shortcomings of the kings that are brought out in Chronicles. But the author is strangely selective as he recounts the lives of David and Solomon. For instance, the chronicler does not describe any event in David's life which paints him as immoral and weak. And so there's no record of his running for his life from Saul. There's no mention of his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. There's no mention of his immoral children. There's no mention of Solomon turning away from the Lord. The majority of stories that are being retold are highlighting the royal virtues and showing their goodness and their love and their commitment to God. And so that's the perspective from which the book of Chronicles is written. Now, we're going to determine why that is exactly. He's not trying to shortchange us. He's not trying to hide anything, but he's got a purpose with which he is writing, and we're going to see that, and we're going to see why he includes the things that he does here in just a moment. And then lastly, of course, the books of Samuel and Kings are written largely from the negative perspective, while the book of Chronicles is written largely from the positive perspective. So I've provided all of this information for two purposes. One, to show you just how different the two books are, or rather the three books are. Chronicles is quite different from the books of Samuel and Kings, and it shouldn't be shunted off to the side just because we start to see some similarity in the stories that are being told. A lot of the information is new and gives us a more complete understanding of the lives of the kings of Judah. But secondly, looking so at the differences help us understand the purpose of the book. Remember, Samuel and Kings was written sometime shortly after the exile. And because of that, Chronicles was also written after the people had returned. And so when you put those things together and all of the things, the eight things that we previously looked at, and you tie in the songs that we sang about the hope and promises of God, the purpose of the book of Chronicles was this, that it was to reestablish hope for the people of Judah. As we put all these things together, we see that this was the chronicler's purpose, was to restore hope to Judah. He wants his people to understand their story isn't over, because we can't appreciate the state in which Judah existed unless we go back and familiarize ourselves with the text, what they're dealing with, what the state of the people was spiritually, what was going on with the nation at the time. And so although their return from captivity was a step in the right direction, this is one of the lowest points in Judah's history. Returning to Jerusalem, seeing the wall that was torn down, seeing the temple that had been desecrated and demolished by Nebuchadnezzar was a gut punch that took the air out of this people. When Nebuchadnezzar took the city, captured Jerusalem, he absolutely decimated it. He destroyed and looted the temple. He tore down the walls. And so Jerusalem has been made into a rubble heap. And when the people go back, yes, it's a good thing, but that's what they are seeing. That's what they're looking at. Their city, their temple has been destroyed. And so when Cyrus sends the people back and says, you can go home now. People don't really want to go. They've gotten comfortable in Babylon. And they've got homes and lives and families there. They've got jobs and work. And there's some stability. Why would they want to leave Babylon and go back to Jerusalem when there is nothing that's there for them? And so with the help of Ezra and Nehemiah, they do go back. They rebuild the city walls through the help of Zerubbabel and the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. The temple is rebuilt, but it didn't compare. It was a shadow of its former self. After the temple was completed, rather the second temple was completed, those who had never seen the Temple of Solomon shouted out for great joy. How wonderful. God's glory can once again be returned to the people because His temple is here. But the people who had saw Solomon's temple, they cried out with sorrow because they realized this is nothing in comparison to the great temple that Solomon had built for the Lord. The nation no longer had a king. They had a governor. They wouldn't have a king for another 450 years. The spiritual state of Judah was not much better than their physical state. Apathy abounded. Read the book of Malachi, which is written around this time period, and you sense apathy and disgust with worship and service to God. People were going through the motion. It had become a chore. Their heart wasn't in it anymore. And so the zeal that had once burned bright simply wasn't in them anymore. And they're just filled with despair. They're filled with apathy. And they wonder, is God ever going to fulfill what He promised through the prophets? Is He going to restore our former glory? And here we've arrived at the purpose. Yes, the chronicler says, He will. Have hope. And so what he does is he recounts Israel's history. He reminds them of the promises. And he spends a lot of time talking about David. And he exalts all of the wonderful, generous, kind things, benevolent things, faithful things that David and the other kings did. Because he's showing a picture of the David who was to come. And you'll remember back in the book is the great promise that God made with David. You always have a man on the throne. And so he's reminding the people, hey, the son of David hasn't come yet. And he's going to restore the temple. And he's going to set us free. And he's going to sit on David's throne. And he's going to reign. And he's going to exalt the nation. And so this book was written to give a devastated people hope. It was written to give a devastated people hope. Let's look real quickly for Jesus in this. Jesus is hiding at the very beginning in all of those genealogies, for one, that we don't read, that we get lost in. Jesus is hiding in the genealogies. Because in the genealogies, there are a few that are emphasized and that are kind of lifted up to the front and elevated over all of the others. You have the lineage of Abraham to David, and then you've got the lineage of Judah that traces the kingship throughout David. And the chronicler wants them to say, David's heir, the Messiah, has not come yet. And so Jesus is there in the genealogies of David. He's there in the genealogy of the priest. Because Hebrews tells us he's not just going to be from the tribe of David, he's also going to be a priest and king. And so the Levitical priesthood is carried forward to show that, yes, God still has plans for this people because the priesthood is known and they can return to their duties and their service. And there's going to be this great priest king that's going to come later. And so David is hiding there in the genealogies. And you might say he's also there by contrast because all of the wicked kings that had come before him were not the fulfillment that Jesus was going to be when he finally came. We see Jesus in the Davidic covenant. And if you want to jot this down, it's in 1 Chronicles 17, 11 through 15. 1 Chronicles 17, 11 through 15, where the promise that was made to David is reiterated. And the chronicler is reminding the people, he's still coming. Have hope. Hold on to the promise of God. God's faithful. God will not let you down. And then finally, we see Jesus in the temple. We see Jesus in the temple. Go real quick to 2 Chronicles and let's read just a few verses here. 2 Chronicles chapter 7. Okay. This is at the completion of the temple. Solomon offers this wonderful prayer dedicating the temple. Watch what happens. 2 Chronicles 7 starting in verse 1. Now when Solomon had finished praying, Fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offerings and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the house. That's a temple. The priests could not enter into the house because the glory of the Lord filled the Lord's house. And all the sons of Israel, seeing the fire come down and the glory of the Lord descend upon the house, bowed down on the pavement with their faces to the ground, and they worshiped him and gave praise to him, saying, truly he is good, truly his loving kindness is everlasting. And so there in the temple built by Solomon, the Shekinah glory comes down from heaven, the presence of God dwelling among the people. Jesus is in the temple. John, chapter 1, and first verse 14. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, and we beheld his glory. The glory that was in the temple was fulfilled in the person Jesus Christ. And what was it Jesus said in John chapter 2 and verse 19? Tear this temple down. I'll rebuild it in 3 days. Now, we know he was talking about his body, but in the temple we see a foreshadowing of Jesus. That is the glory of God in the presence of man. Let me leave you with just a few lessons in the time that we have remaining. Lesson one, people are important. That's why the Holy Spirit, by inspiration of the chronicler, recorded all of those names, because people are important. And just as we don't read the cast at the end of a movie, all of those people have a part to play in God's plan. You have a part to play in God's plan, because the story isn't over. Secondly, God is bigger than your past. And I'd encourage you to take the time and read 2 Chronicles 33, because it tells the story of the most wicked, the most heinous king that Israel or Judah has ever seen, a man by the name of Manasseh. And here we have, once again, the highlighted difference of the kings and Samuel in the book of Chronicles. Because Manasseh's reign is talked about in 2 Kings, I believe, and all you have are the atrocities that he committed. That's all you have about Manasseh recorded. Simply the sins against God, the sins against the people, the sins against the temple. But you come to 2 Chronicles, and you have a little information that the other side of the story didn't tell. Manasseh's taken away into captivity. Manasseh repents. Manasseh receives the grace of God, and he's sent back home, and he starts to straighten things out to the best of his ability. He can't undo everything that he's done. And kings would tell you that it's Manasseh's actions that propelled them onto a collision course with exile that God simply was not going to relent on. But Chronicles wants you to know Manasseh wasn't 100% wicked. There was some good there too. He repented, he returned, and he tried his best to straighten out, because God is bigger than your past. Faith is infectious. I just want to read this passage with you from 1 Chronicles chapter 20. If you look there at 1 Chronicles chapter 20, I want to read a few verses. These are some of the gems that you get out here that you find that you're simply going to not have if you dismiss it as redundant and repetitive and just skip over it, because this isn't recorded for us in Samuel or Kings. 1 Chronicles chapter 20, 4 through 8, and this is the lesson here: faith is infectious. Now it came about after this that war broke out at Gezer with the Philistines. Then Sibekai the Hushathite killed Sipai, one of the descendants of the giants. They were subdued. And there was war with the Philistines again, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, killed Lami, the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Again there was war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature, who had 24 fingers and toes, 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, and he was descended from the giants. And when he taunted Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimea, David's brother, killed him. These were descended from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Why do you think it was that any of the people had the courage to stand up and fight Philistine giants? Because many years ago, a young shepherd boy had the courage to go before the people who were trembling with fear as the giant stood there mocking the people, mocking their God, and said, I will take him out. And he did. And that faith was infectious, and it spread to others who said, if he can kill giants, then God will be with us and we can kill giants. In fact, it's one of David's nephews who rises up and takes out this Philistine giant later on. Understand, faith is infectious. David's faith was spread throughout all of Israel so that the people were able to see and have courage in God. We were doing a gospel meeting in Jacksonville, I guess, back in last October. And Whitney had gone largely to see a friend and spend some time with her there. She had a good drive. And with kids, we didn't know if we wanted to get out and have them out till 9 o'clock every night, 10 o'clock by the time they could get to bed. So we weren't really sure what we were going to do regarding her attendance at the meeting. You know, I had an obligation to be there. But she decided she was going to go every night. And so she goes Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Later on in the week, there was an older lady who came up to me and said, "I almost didn't come today. But then I looked at your wife, and I said, if she can get out with those three kids, so can I. And so I came. That's why I'm here." You see, faith is infectious. Faith spreads to others. And so never discount the things that you do, the good works that you do, the faith that you show in God. And understand, your presence here is going to impact someone else because people are watching. In fact, that's the very point of the great attendance passage in Hebrews 10:25, where it says, "Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together." The passage is tied together by verse 24, which says, "Let us stimulate one another for love and good works." By being here, what we're doing is we're building one another up. Our presence here is significant. So please, please never write off the good things that you may do, even if it's something which to you seems as simple as coming here and worshiping God anytime you have the opportunity. Because faith is infectious, and that goes a long way. Well, the book of Chronicles is a wonderful book, and I encourage you to take the time and to read that and to mine some of the jewels that are there for yourself to find personal application which you can live by and which will enhance your walk with the Lord. Will you bow with me as we dismiss in a word of prayer?